Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager. And today, before we get the episode started, there's a few things that we want to let you, our audience, know about up top that are coming up in the month of October, which is one of our favorite months here. First of all, we are going to start doing listener mail episodes over Periscope. We're going to attempt this. If you've ever used the Periscope app before, it's connected to Twitter. We've been getting so much listener mail lately that we don't really feel like we could do it justice in one podcast episode. So we figured we'd give this Periscope thing a try, and we're going to try it out on Friday, October 23rd. The second thing that we want to let you know about is the return of Monster Science. Now, if you're a listener of the podcast, but you've never seen any of the videos before, I have to recommend that you check these out. I wasn't involved in the original ones, and it's one of my favorite things that we've ever produced here at How Stuff Works. Robert, you want to talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah, we have four new episodes coming at you. In each one, Dr. Anton Jessup discusses the fictional world of monsters as well as the real world, the real natural world of biology. And finds comparisons to make between the two. So it's always a fun video.
It's great. Yeah, and it has so much value to, like, the effects that are in it that our producer Tyler throws in, and also, like, some really cool background props and items that you guys get to work with. So if you're into horror, if you're excited about Halloween in October and you love science like we do, you should totally check out Monster Science. It's already, the first two seasons are already on YouTube, and if you follow us on Facebook, we're going to be posting at least one or two episodes a week directly there for the next couple of weeks leading up to Halloween and the new season.
Yeah, so you can sort of follow the very loose narrative that goes through all of these.
Yeah, and real quick before we get started, just, you know, if you want to find out any of this stuff and you're a fan of the show and you haven't had the opportunity to learn about these yet, definitely, you know, follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter and Tumblr. All those platforms were Blow the Mind. There's also the homepage, stufftoblowyourmind.com, which is full of blog posts that Robert and I and Joe work on, and videos, older videos that Robert and Julie used to do, and including all the Monster Science stuff. So definitely just give it a shot.
And speaking of monsters, today we are talking about a topic that has definite ties into the mythological world of monsters, but also ties in very nicely to themes of, you know, biological and chemical weapons,
yeah,
into themes of just natural biology and, of course, natural medicine.
Yeah, this is a topic that, you know, if you had asked me about a week ago before I'd done the research, I would have just had some vague sort of universal pictures, ideas about what this means. So, of course, we're talking about wolfsbane.
Yes, and I honestly, I wasn't completely sure it was real until very recently.
Because me either.
You see, you hear it mentioned, it sounds a little bit too cute, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how do you fight off a werewolf or potentially make a werewolf? It gets convoluted.
Yeah.
Well, you find this plant, this little flower that's occurring, and it's called wolfsbane, ironically enough, and that can be used against the creature.
Yeah, and it turns out this is a real thing, very real, very prominent in Northern Europe, and has a real deep history with a lot of interesting sort of connections to how it's used and the variations in which people have used it to heal and to hurt one another. And the werewolf thing is fascinating, but I also think that it's just, it's got like a very odd kind of horticultural background too.
Yes.
Something that I'd never heard of, maybe because I'm not like 1 foot into the botany world the way I'm 1 foot into the horror world.
Yeah, like it definitely has deep roots, if you will, in the botany world, and also in the world of traditional medicines, especially traditional Chinese medicine.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, what are we actually talking about here? Wolfsbane is what exactly?
Well, we're talking about perennial herbs of the buttercup family, Ranunculaceae.
Okay.
And that's divided into two genera, Aconitum and Erathus.
Yeah, and so Latin is going to be a major thing that pops up here in terms of like the naming conventions surrounding these plants. And I think there's something like 60 different subspecies of these. So forgive us if our Latin isn't up to par and we're not pronouncing these exactly right. But the main thing to know is that this is largely referred to as Aconitum, and we'll also be talking about aconite, which is this deadly poisonous alkaloid that is emitted from the plant primarily from its roots.
Yeah, it's present all through the plant, but in its roots and root tubers, that's where you find the highest concentrations.
Right.
But it's also in the leaves, it's in the flowers, it's in high levels in the pollen.
Yeah, it's crazy dangerous.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why after doing this research, I was like, why don't we all know about this? Because this seems like this incredibly dangerous thing that we just refer about casually in werewolf movies.
Yeah, and we'll discuss some of the dangers ahead, but you find it throughout the Northern Hemisphere. In America, you find it throughout Eurasia, and accidents do occur.
And it's mostly native to mountains. It's known as a rock flower in some parts of the world because it grows up out of spaces in between rocks. But there's primarily two sort of informal categories. There's monk's hood and there's wolfsbane.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called monk's hood because of its shape. So it has this shape to it. They call it the sepals. I guess those are like the upper petals that kind of curve over and look like the hood over like a Capuchin monk or something like that. And there's different colors, right? So the monk's hoods usually are like dark blues or purples. Sometimes you'll find them in white variations, whereas like wolf's bane is usually yellow. Sometimes it's lavender or pink. And those are commonly grown in the Alps of Switzerland, actually, which, again, I had no idea.
Yeah, the hills are alive. And it's important to drive home, too, here, that the reason that this thing is just so filled with toxic alkaloids is because it's in essence a chemical protection against herbivores.
Yeah, I mean, not just some of the ways that this has been used against humans, but also animals, I thought was pretty mortifying, but I guess, you know, maybe I'm coming at it from a modern day standpoint where I wouldn't purposely poison horses, for instance, but we'll get into that. Okay. There's an interesting etymology behind this particular flower. So the name is thought to be derived from the Greek word, I think it's aconiton, which means without struggle. But there's also an idea that it also comes from the Greek word akon, which is a word for dart or javelin, and we'll talk about that later, but it primarily has to do with the substance being coated on those weapons during war.
Used as essentially a chemical weapon,
It's also thought to come from the word akane, which is a word connected to rocky grounds. Like I just said, like it grows up in mountainous regions. And actually Pliny the Elder talked about it in some of his writings. And he said that it might be connected to the port of Akane, which was apparently a place known for evil repute. And that's, you know, again, connected to it because of the whole poison in the aconite thing. So the last one, apparently akon, all those kinds of iterations within Greek all have kind of deadly meanings. So a whetstone is apparently pronounced akon in Greek. And that, so if you don't know, that's the, like, the thing that you use to sharpen a sword, basically. Mm-hmm. And they think that that might also be an origin for it because it, like a whetstone, it makes a blade even deadlier.
So how do people end up finding themselves poisoned by wolfsbane? There are basically two ways, and it depends on where you are in the world. If you reside in the East, particularly if you're in China, then there's a very good chance that you might encounter it through traditional medicine. And if the proportions are long, if it hasn't been prepared properly, yeah. or you take too much of it in its prepared form, then you can become poisoned by the aconite.
Yeah, and it's nasty stuff. And then, you know, there's just the casual, like, walking by it or mm-hmm. accidentally putting it to your lips, too, which, you know, surprisingly happens more often than you'd think. In fact, last year in 2014, there was a 33-year-old gardener named Nathan Greenaway, and he worked at this place called Millcourt House, which was owned by, like, a retired venture capitalist named Christopher Ogilvie Thompson. And apparently they had wolfsbane growing in their giant garden. And Nathan didn't know this. He brushed up against it, and it killed him within a day. And some people speculate, you know, it's worse if you have, like, open wounds on your hands. Apparently this guy wasn't wearing gloves at the time. But it's pretty dangerous. In fact, some people over the years have even mistaken it for horseradish and put the roots in their mouth and died from it. So it leads to bad results. And before we get into the werewolves and the poisons and the herbology and all that stuff, we'll just kind of briefly talk about why this thing is so toxic. So we know that the roots and the tubers are especially toxic. It's really prevalent, especially, you know, it can be absorbed through your skin, and has to be handled with extreme care because of those alkaloids that we were talking about before. But what is the actual effect of this thing, right? So, it produces a topical tingling at first, kind of like an anesthetic, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
And followed by, I guess, like, it's an altered state. I wouldn't call it hallucinating, but it's kind of like your mind is affected. And we'll talk about different ways in which people have used it purposely to affect their own minds. But it sounds to me like it's sort of like a state that slows down the mind and sort of puts most things out of your thoughts so you can focus singularly.
Yeah, and there's a lot of mention in the literature about, particularly when we get into its uses of poison, that that it you remain very clear headed until the very end,
right?
So it's kind of adding to the nefarious nature of it as a weapon.
Having just gone under anesthetic yesterday, mm-hmm. I can imagine what the effects are like. But so all you need is 3 to 6 milligrams of aconite to kill a healthy adult. Like, this stuff is so potent. Just like a few grams of the plant matter, touching your hands or obviously being ingested is super dangerous. And I found there's an old 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica entry that mentioned that some people purposely put the petal or the roots to their lips to produce, like, a numbness or a tingling. I guess it's like the whippets of the turn of the century.
Yeah, a very dangerous practice indeed, though, because you need to make sure you just get enough of it to inspire tingling and numbness and not, you know, poison you to death.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the horse thing, which I found unfortunate. But apparently horse dealers used to use this. They'd feed it to their horses before they brought their animals to market. And the reason why was it works the opposite on horses. It stimulates horses and makes them lively. So if you had an old, tired horse and you're trying to get rid of it, you give it a little bit of wolfsbane, bring it to market, and it appears more lively, and you're more likely to sell it. And then, you know, the person who buys it gets it home and realizes that this is a very tired horse.
All right, well, let's get into the werewolf mythology a little bit. And I think, like, one of the key things here that we keep finding is that you see wolfsbane mentioned as both a preventative measure and also the cause of lycanthropy.
Yeah, that was the thing that was confusing to me. So before going into this, I'd always heard of it through the myths, I guess, or the fiction mm-hmm. that I'd encountered as being the thing that you use. It's like, other than a silver bullet, it's like the only thing that can stop a werewolf, right?
Yeah.
I think there's like a Marvel Comics, like X-Men character whose name, I know. There's an X-Men character named Wolfsbane. The name doesn't really make sense because, as you'd suspect, her power is that she transforms into a werewolf. So what, like, I don't understand, I guess, why there's the divergence in the mythos there of, like, it's the thing that'll kill a werewolf, but it's also the thing that'll turn you into a werewolf.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just so tied to how a werewolf works that you can.
Yeah,
I mean, it kind of represents the dual nature of the substance itself, right?
Right.
In correct proportions, it can be used as a medicine, and in strong enough doses, which doesn't take very much, as we've already discussed, you have a dire weapon on your hands.
You know what? That's a really good point, actually. And so, there's definitely historical connections to the poison part, because Akhenaton, Lycaonotum, this is the genus that's essentially the wolfsbane, the mm-hmm. like prominent wolfsbane. It was originally used as a way to kill panthers and wolves and other, quote, wild beasts. And it was considered deadly to them. One of the quotes that I read from an old textbook said, "It kills them in the same day if you put the root or the leaf on the animal's genitals." So I don't know how they're grabbing a wolf and rubbing the leaves of wolfsbane on its genitals. But the other thing that I heard was that they used to lure wolves out, but they would take like chunks of raw meat mm-hmm. and they would mix in wolfsbane juice essentially into this stuff, throw it out. Everybody'd go into their homes. The wolves would come out and eat the stuff and be dead like a day later.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the connection here between wolfsbane and using it as a deterrent against wolves. And there are some arguments that the werewolf myth has its roots, you know, not only in sort of the dual nature of man as
right.
A beast, but also a higher animal, but also in our older struggles against wolves, where we were having to compete against wolves for resources.
Yeah, it's not something that we run into on a daily basis now, or at least I guess maybe in our culture we don't, but I was thinking about this, like, as I was doing the research, my dog often hangs out next to my office mm-hmm. desk and just kind of, looks up at me, and occasionally I pet him and stuff. And I thought, well, we have a very different relationship with these animals today.
Yeah. I mean, of course you can look at very recent history in the United States, even with the poisoning of wolves
mm-hmm.
In very large numbers, to the point where we've had to help bring the numbers back up in the wild. So we have a very troubled history with the canines.
But so there's a lot of folklore connected to mm-hmm. this. And I think you're right to say that it comes from the sort of dual nature of it being both a poison and a cure.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Uses directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots.
the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of our favorite Netflix series, Bridgerton. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? And meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. And I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
Yeah, I was looking in the LaRousse Dictionary of World Folklore, and it's pointed out there that, according to some folk beliefs, that if you applied a fatal dose, Wolfsbane would repel a werewolf, which which seems kind of like a no-brainer.
It would repel anything, theoretically.
Like, this is a powerful poison, so I should hope it would work against the werewolf that's threatening my village.
Right.
If it doesn't, then I'm kind of boned, right?
Yeah, I mean, even in the horse case, I think it's still poisonous.
Yeah.
It just has different sort of side effects.
Right. And in the LaRousse Dictionary of World Folklore also mentioned that as an ointment, it could transform a sorcerer into a werewolf.
Okay.
Though obviously a very careful dosage would be needed to avoid certain death. And it's also mentioned that it's possible that like a correct dosage level might have created or helped to create an hallucinogenic effect, which I'm not as sure about, based on our reading, especially, the descriptions of aconite poisoning keeping you pretty stable in the mind up until the very end, with some possible effects on how you're perceiving the world, but not like a strong hallucinatory effect. So I'm not so sure about sorcerers taking aconite and having a werewolf paranormal experience, unless they are combining, say, the physical numbness with some other agent.
Yeah, I might be jumping a little bit ahead here, but I think I have a theory for where this werewolf thing came from, and maybe not the sorcerer's standpoint, from the people watching somebody proclaiming themselves to be a sorcerer taking this stuff.
Okay.
So there's two things. First of all, when you're poisoned by this, a lot of times you end up foaming at the mouth. So there's clearly a connection there. In fact, there's a connection to the hellhound Cerberus that we'll talk about in a moment. But there's, also this idea apparently that German berserkers used to take it right before they would go into battle because they wanted to be mindless right before they went into a fight. And again, they would foam at the mouth, supposedly. So you had these German berserkers running at you, foaming at the mouth. And I can see where folklore would spin out from that, that like these men had turned themselves into beasts, you know, somehow, and they were sacrificing their humanity in order to win the war.
Huh. Remembering some of the various symptoms of aconite poisoning, though, it's like I'm imagining this berserker running into battle. He's foaming at the mouth. He's kind of numb all over.
Yeah.
Fierce diarrhea. Like, you know, so I guess
right.
he's
vomiting.
And then collapsing and twitching.
Yeah,
and
it's definitely like if you're going to take this stuff, it's like a kamikaze maneuver, right? Because there's no way you're coming back from that fight.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it. Now, in terms of causing werewolves. So, you know, we're not going to spend too much more time on this podcast talking about werewolves, but I did want to run through some of the many ways you can turn into a werewolf according to world folklore.
Okay.
And these come from Carol Rose's always excellent Giants, Monsters, and Dragons, an Encyclopedia of Folklore, Legend, and Myth. So let's just roll back and forth on this list here.
Okay.
First up, classic lunar-induced transformation. Full moon pops out.
Right.
Turns you into a wolf.
And then there's, of course, the curse. Like somebody curses you and you become a werewolf.
Right. Then there's magical pelt-induced transformation, which we don't see enough of.
You know, how does that work? You wear the pelt of the wolf?
Yeah, you have like a magical wolf pelt, and you put it on, and then you become a wolf. Yeah.
All right. And then there's something called new moon conception-induced transformation. What's that? Just when the moon is new?
You were conceived during a new moon.
Oh.
And then obviously you're going to be born a werewolf.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Okay. All right.
Here's a variation on that. Friday full moon slumber-induced transformation. So this one is basically there's a full moon on a Friday. You sleep during it. Boom, you're a werewolf.
Wow. Well, I would be in werewolf trouble then because that happens a lot. And then there's, of course, if a wolf touched the water that you're consuming, that's something that would theoretically turn you into a werewolf.
Yeah, that one. That
makes sense.
Makes a little sense, yeah. Just you're coming into sort of contact with the beast.
Yeah.
Wolf brain consumption-induced transformation. So you eat the brain of a wolf, and then you take on partially the mind and spirit of a wolf. Okay.
And then so this next one, it sounds like it's a wolf and human flesh combined. You eat it, and then you become by eating the two things together, you merge them so that you're sort of a bipedal wolf creature.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's ancient Greek.
Yeah, that's an ancient Greek one there.
Okay.
Then bestiality-induced transformation also makes sense. You're laying with the beast, and therefore you're becoming partially beast.
Okay. So Catherine the Great would then, like, be half horse.
I mean, if you buy into those myths.
Right, yeah. Well, I buy into the wolf brain consumption one. Why wouldn't I? And, we've also got overzealous Zeus worship. transformation. So if you're too into Zeus, there's a certain amount of worshiping Zeus that works. But if you're too into Zeus, you can turn into a werewolf.
Yes, and that comes from the Greek myth of Lycanon, and there are some other details going on in that story too. But essentially, the root there is he was just really overzealous.
Yeah.
There's seasonal feast-induced transformation. Herodotus talks about this a little bit in his writings that there were Nehru tribal sorcerers who would just turn at these occasional, seasonal feasts.
And, of course, there's witchcraft, which is similar to the curse thing. We've seen that as an origin story, I think, in some of the sort of modern fiction, right?
Yeah.
That it's a curse. They're creating sort of a, I don't know, like a bestial bodyguard or something. Or cursing an enemy.
And you see that popping up in witchcraft trial accounts as well. Like, this guy here, he clearly turned into a wolf and he was killing people in the area, so we're going to have to take care of him. And then finally, having eaten certain herbs, namely wolfsbane.
So they didn't list the one that I think of as like the primary method, which is being bitten or clawed at by a werewolf.
Yeah, she didn't mention that in the werewolf entry, which makes me wonder to what extent that was just borrowed from the vampire mythology.
Yeah, you know? For Hollywood purposes, it's an easy way to make a werewolf in a movie. And then you end up tracing it back to a kind of chicken or egg type situation, right? Like how did the first werewolf become a werewolf? So it's got to be one of those things that we just mentioned.
Because anytime you can introduce a contagion into your horror story or your monster mythology, you know, it makes it all the more pervasive.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So we mentioned Cerberus earlier.
Yeah. So the Cerberus thing is really interesting. The idea here is from Greek myth. And I think it's that Hercules was fighting Cerberus or dragging it up.
He had to drag it up. her, it, they?
I think it's male.
Yeah.
In the mythos, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But, and that as he was dragging it up from Hades, Cerberus was drooling as three-headed dogs do, and the drool fell on the ground, and where it fell is where Wolfsbane first started to grow, or aconite.
And that sounds logical. You have a magical beast, it's coming up, it's drooling all over the place, magical things are gonna happen.
Yeah, I mean, just as logical as, like, drinking the same water as a wolf would turn you into a werewolf. So, yeah, I follow it. It's a good story, though. This is one of those, like, when Hercules did, like, the various labors, right?
Yeah, this was definitely one of the labors, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, thanks, Hercules.
You got popular, Hercules, and you were able to prove that you were a legend, and the rest of us got werewolves.
Yeah, and poisonings.
So, okay, Wolfsbane, we've talked about how poisonous this stuff is and how it's so reviled that it's connected to this long lore of werewolves in most cultures, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's a cure or whether it's a poison to werewolves, it's connected to them somehow. So how is it? People have used it, though, as medicine for centuries as well. And we think that may be where the sort of cure for werewolfism comes from.
Yeah, certainly.
Werewolfism, lycanthropy.
Yeah.
Let's use the D&D language here.
Yeah, certainly in Western traditions. And some think, too, that you have medieval witches that, at least those individuals who are actually tied to traditional traditions of using native herbs in the treatment of maladies, as opposed to individuals who are just caught up in the storm of witchcraft persecution, that those individuals might have utilized Wolfsbane for its curative properties, or even, you know, in some cases, its destructive properties.
Yeah, even outside of the whole Wolfsbane thing. Again, remember, there's two sort of sub-classifications here, and monkshood is one of them, and monkshood was also associated with black magic and dark medicines, and obviously because of its poisonous traits.
Meanwhile, over, across the continent, and the relatively werewolf-free region of China, you see aconite used for about 2,000 years as an essential drug in traditional Chinese medicine. And a number of these details about this got this from an article published in the 2009 edition of the Journal of Ethnopharmacology titled Aconitum in Traditional Chinese Medicine, a Valuable Drug or an Unpredictable Risk? Because it all comes down to the toxicity levels.
I like that we're still debating this.
Yeah.
That we're still like, maybe. I mentioned this to a friend of mine this morning, and he compared it to chemotherapy.
Yeah.
He was like, well, yeah, I mean, think about it. It's, a thing that's like really, ultimately like causing you pain and is really dangerous to your body. But
yeah, I mean, when you look at a lot of the naturally occurring agents that we use in traditional medicines or even in just for culinary use, spices, at appropriate levels, these can add flavor to your dish. At higher levels, they can prove toxic to your body, and that's just, that kind of ties into what they're originally there for. They're there as a plant's chemical defense system, and we've found ways to hijack a lot of these defense systems for our own benefit.
Yeah, that's kind of the miraculous thing, right? Of like how human culture has over the years figured all these things out. Like, how many people had to touch it to their lips and die or eat a certain quantity before they figured out exactly the right amount that they could use for medicinal purposes. And in this Chinese usage, it's very clear that they have to process it in an elaborate way for it to be safe.
That's right. There are these traditional Chinese processing methods, referred to as, Paozi, which play an essential role in detoxifying the aconite. So typically, the Paozi consists of several different methods of heating the substance. So you're roasting it, you're honey frying it, you're wine frying it, earth frying it, vinegar frying it, or various other means. And we also have additional modern methods, which basically boil down to the same thing, using heat to detoxify it to a level to where you can consume it.
So we're like burning off the alkaloid content?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Boiling it down, burning it off to the level where you can take advantage of the benefits without having to worry as much about poisoning yourself. And all told, the Paozi process reduces the alkaloid content by up to 90%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. Because I don't really recall like a process like that in the literature on the European usages. It's more like tincture type stuff that they're making.
Yeah, you're more playing with fire.
Yeah, it's like one part per it's in the notes, but like one part per 50 or something like that is what you do. So, okay, so they've got this elaborate process. They reduce the amount of alkaloids that's in there. What are they using it for in particular? Like, what is it a cure for?
Well,
not a cure, but I guess a remedy.
Well, first of all, I should draw a finer line on how it actually works.
Okay.
So everyone can get an idea here. So it acts on the voltage sensitive sodium channels of the cell membranes of excitable tissues, including tissue of the heart, mm-hmm. nerves, and muscles. So it stimulates and then if the dosage is high enough, later paralyzes the nerves. And if it's applied to broken skin, the initial tingling becomes kind of an anesthetic action.
Yeah. So that's what I recalled reading about the European variations. Mm-hmm. But one of the things was that they never ingest it. It's always used as like an ointment or something like that, because ingestion would obviously increase the amount of risk that this alkaloid is going to be interacting with your cells. So I'm assuming that this Chinese variation is also not eaten?
Yeah, I believe so, especially based on that that significant detoxification.
Right.
Again, the ideal detoxification, because the vast majority of aconite poisonings that still occur in China, in India, throughout Asia, are due to incorrect levels
overdosing.
In medicine. Yeah.
Yeah. So presumably, I mean, even though you're burning off 90% of it during that process, if you take enough of it, you're going to be poisoning yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Again. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So it's used homeopathically, right?
Yeah, you see homeopathic uses of aconite to treat stress. You see it as a treatment for stress in various
not just usages. Chinese culture.
Yeah, but also cold relief, pain relief, aches and pain.
Yeah, I read that the Greeks used to use it specifically for eye pain, mm-hmm. and so I'm curious about that, because do you make like eye drops and drop it in there, or do you?
Hmm.
And it's particularly, as we were talking about that gardener earlier who was hurt, it's particularly bad if you get the alkaloid directly in your eye.
Right.
So that was curious to me, but in all cultures, the European and Chinese uses, they're using it to treat pains, agitation, indigestion, all kinds of conditions. I read facial paralysis is one. In particular, it's used for neuralgia.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have like facial neuralgia, you take an ointment of this and you rub it on the area until it's numb, so that you're no longer feeling pain. So it's a painkiller.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in addition to facial paralysis, you see it used to treat joint pain, gout, finger numbness, cold hands and feet, which granted would be due to other conditions and not just, feeling kind of cold.
Yeah. I'm not going to put the socks on. Why don't we take some poison?
Inflammation, painful breathing, fluid in the space surrounding the lungs, certain heart problems, fever, skin diseases, hair loss even.
Wow.
Which seems like a stretch, but, I guess the thing is its basic numbing feature. Like, it's something you can definitely feel an aconite-derived medication working in your system.
Yeah.
So even if you're just going to apply the placebo effect, you can say, ooh, I feel different, and maybe that difference I'm feeling is treating it.
I would imagine that it works somewhat like a tranquilizer in certain doses, right? So I know that in some of the instances they use it to treat anxiety and nervous disorders, especially like what we would today call post-traumatic stress disorder. But like, if you had a traumatic event in your life,
mm-hmm.
and you were subsequently having trouble dealing with it, they would give you this because of that, what we were talking about, that clear-headed kind of mind-numbing feeling of it that the German berserkers would use for a very different effect.
Right. Yeah, so even if it's not able to directly treat the condition that's ailing you, it could at least have some effect on your stress level surrounding that condition. So
yeah.
That makes sense.
But I'm curious, like, the literature made it sound like there are places in the world right now that people are still using it in such ways.
Throughout China and India. And then you see it used homeopathically here in the West, too.
I wonder if anybody out there who's listening has used it before. And if they have, I'd love to hear from you what the effects are like. Is it just like, a tranquilizer or kind of anesthetic, or is it different? But, that's the That's the curative side. That's the medicinal side. So
yes.
Now let's get into the nasty stuff.
Because we would also love to hear from any listeners who have been shot with an aconite-laced arrow.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody out there who's used it as a biological weapon. And that was one of the things that I kept thinking about when I was looking at this research was like, wow, like I'm surprised that there aren't more like poison assassination kind of attempts regarding this, because from what I was reading, it essentially just looks like the person asphyxiated. There aren't traces of this stuff after it's been ingested.
Yeah, because it seemed it's relatively easy to cultivate and acquire.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think there would be more cases of nefarious aconite poisoning as
maybe
opposed
there
to
are. Maybe there are, and we just don't know
because
because it doesn't leave that much of a trace behind. But it has been considered the most dangerous and poisonous plant in all of Europe, though, for a long time. And in European art, it's been depicted as a symbol of death and used in as ritual poison in certain societies. So a kind of Jim Jones Kool-Aid type thing, it sounds like.
It's crazy how so much of this is lost beneath the, vague mentions in werewolf myths. Cause again, It sounds like just this fanciful thing that, it almost sounds like it would have no effect on anything but a werewolf.
Right.
But in effect, it's like saying, oh, you need to kill a werewolf. Why don't you try using dynamite?
Yeah.
Which would work against most things, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of our favorite Netflix series, Bridgerton. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? And meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. And I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, how does it kill you?
Oh, yeah.
I'm assuming the way that it kills you is the same way that it makes you feel numb, right?
It's
just an enhanced version of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So based on the research we were doing, it seems like it would roll out like this. First of all, you're poisoned in some way. Either you're either the enemy has poisoned the well and you're drinking poisoned water, or you've been shot, stabbed, or bludgeoned with with a wolfsbane laced weapon, right?
Yep.
So after that shock, you're going to get a sensation of burning, tingling, numbness in the mouth, which I guess might be kind of nice at first since you're not feeling that arrow poking out of your body.
Yeah, exactly.
Then there's a burning in your abdomen. And it's said that death usually supervenes at this point before the numbing effect on the intestine can be observed. But that's where it goes next, right? Pretty soon you're vomiting.
Yeah, and so to clarify, like the same thing, like this neurotoxin is opening up sodium channels inside your body, which cause the tingling, but it also spreads throughout your entire body, right? It's essentially paralyzing your circulatory and respiratory system, and that's what leads to death.
Yeah, yeah. You end up dying from asphyxia. And through all of this, though, you're supposedly conscious and clear-minded to the last. So you're laying there on the battlefield, staring at this arrow protruding from your shoulder, and you're thinking, oh, well, I'm not really feeling this arrow all that much. I'm feeling kind of numb.
Yeah.
Must be the aconite. Must be the wolfsbane. I guess I'm not long for this world.
Huh. Yeah. And it's just, it basically sounds like all of the symptoms of like the worst possible cold hitting you suddenly, right? Or like flu, right? Like you're dizzy, you're nauseous, you're vomiting, your motor skills start slowing down and becoming weak. Your circulatory system slows down, your respiration slows down, and then boom, that leads to you being unconscious and then followed up by you're dead because within an hour of consuming it, it can kill somebody. And like we said, it's the death for the most part is from the asphyxia, not from the arrow wound or the knife wound or whatever, however it's delivered. The only postmortem signs are from asphyxia. And there aren't a lot of ways to treat this. That 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica I was looking at, they suggested emptying the stomach by tube, which I don't know is necessarily how we'd handle it today. There are a couple antidotes, atropine, digitalin, and strophanthine. All of those, if they're injected subcutaneously, I think can counteract these effects. This was the old wives' tale, remedy that I found that was listed was that you take olive oil and you mix it with laurel berries and the corpses of several dozen flies, but they have to be flies that have fed on the foliage of aconite.
So you have to have this brood ahead of time, basically.
Exactly.
And you have to cultivate wolfsbane in order to harvest the flies and therefore remain in fairly close contact with the poisonous substance.
So. Exactly. Yeah. So it's not – this is probably not going to be a remedy that's on hand within the hour you've got to live, basically,
right.
Unless you've got like a – some kind of a witch doctor medicine woman in town who just happens to have this concoction pre-made.
Yeah, or if you happen to have some on the battlefield with you. Because we see, for instance, in Nepal, where you have a particularly poisonous variety of wolfsbane, there was a long history of warriors using it, using the flower to tip their arrows or poison enemy wells. And interestingly enough, the Odyssey mentions Ulysses traveling to Epiros to collect arrow poison, and some people believe that historians believe that this was aconite.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just been used throughout history in a lot of different ways, right? Obviously, the Greeks have a history of it. You mentioned Nepal. China, but then there's also apparently the Nazis were looking at ways to use it to lace bullets.
Yeah, this this comes out of the concentration camp experiments. So it's mentioned in the Nuremberg trial proceedings. Quote, on 11th of September 1944, in the presence of SS Sturmbannführer Dr. Ding, Dr. Widman, and the undersigned, experiments with aconite nitrate bullets were carried out on five persons who had been sentenced to death. The caliber of the bullets used was 7.65 millimeters, and they were filled with poison in crystal form. Each subject of the experiment received one shot in the upper part of the left thigh while in a horizontal position. In the case of two persons, the bullets passed clean through the upper part of the thigh. Even later, no effect from the poison could be seen. These two subjects were therefore rejected. So, essentially, it was a failed experiment.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to have any effect.
You hear about these Nazi, like, science experiments that were conducted on human prisoners, and it's it's mind-blowing. But this one in particular, I just can't imagine. I mean, knowing even, like, from the 1911 Britannica encyclopedia that I was reading from earlier, it pretty clearly understood the effects of it and how it worked. So filling a bullet with crystallized wolfsbane seems like it wouldn't work to me, because how is it going to come in contact with your skin or your circulation? Even if it's going through your body, it's still protected by a metal casing.
Yeah, I mean, you could say this for a lot of the experiments that took case that took place in, under these circumstances, though it seems very misguided.
Because
you're taking an old notion of poisoned weaponry and trying to apply it to modern ballistics in a way that doesn't really match it up. Like, I know there have been other experiments into poisoning bullets in various ways, but I can't think of a single one offhand where there was any real level of success with poison munitions.
Yeah, and it just sounds to me too like it was even something like they probably knew it wasn't going to work, but it was just sort of a sick way to torture these people, you know, slowly. But it's there it is on the record.
Yeah,
it was absolutely used.
It's in the history books.
Yeah.
But again, they were clearly inspired by the long use of aconite as a weapon, particularly in Chinese botany, where there were five different species that were particularly used for arrow poison.
Right. It is a species of the plant itself. They're laced on the arrows. And apparently in ancient Greece, they did the same thing. The shepherds would actually take arrows, lace them with this stuff, and bait as well, like I was talking about earlier. And again, use them to kill wolves. So we see, like, there's a lot of iterations of using this to kill wolves that trace back to that werewolf stuff we were talking about earlier. I guess I can see, like, you coat it with an arrow, it goes in your body. That's going to work, right? Because the poison is coming into contact with your internal organs.
Right.
But the bullet transition is where I get lost.
Yeah.
Nazi logic. Not real tight.
But, you know, outside of the world of human warfare and human medicine and accidental human poisonings, you do have some organisms that regularly and in one case exclusively feed on wolfsbane and have an extremely high tolerance for aconite.
Yeah, this gives you like I think this is a great example of just how different our biological systems work from insects. That, like, yeah, I talked about the horse earlier and that the side effects made it a little lively as compared to, like, numbing that it does in humans or wolves, I guess. But the tiger moths and certain kinds of bees, right?
Yeah.
Eating.
One bee in particular, and I'll go ahead and mention this one first, because this is an example of you have this plant, and it's highly toxic, as we've discussed, and it ends up being visited by a number of different bees, different pollinators, and it needs to be pollinated. So it can't just be completely isolationist, right? It can't just poison everything that comes near it.
Yeah.
Keep the cows away, sure, but the bees need to get in. And while the pollen has a fairly high levels of toxicity, the nectar itself has low levels of alkaloids. So it's difficult to acquire that nectar without specialized mouth parts. So you end up with a situation where where the plant itself encourages specialist pollinators.
Okay.
And in this case, we see the so-called old world bumblebee or Bombus consobrinus. And you see this particular bee throughout Eurasia. And it has simply evolved into that niche where this is a very dangerous plant to deal with, but it can deal with it delicately. And as such, as they play a vital role in each other's life cycles.
Yeah, so it sounds like the old world bumblebee and these plants co-evolved, right?
Yeah.
So that they adapted survival mechanisms together.
I was looking at a study. Does a certain type of aconitum chemically protect floral rewards to the advantage of specialist bumblebees? And this is a 2013 study from Ecological Entomology, and they were looking at the levels of aconite in the bodies of both the specialist bees and the generalist bees.
Yeah,
and it really did seem to drive home that the specialist is where it's at for
right.
this particular plant.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So it's not just like it would be easy for me to say, oh, well, insects are fine with it, but mammals are not or whatever. But it's a very particular kind of bee that can
right.
do this. But then there's also the moths, right?
Right.
And this is relatively recent. I think this study popped up on our radar this year, didn't it?
Yeah, this was a 2015 Russian study that came out and pointed out first that there are 18 species of butterflies and moths that are known aconite feeders, as caterpillars, of course.
Right, right.
And this includes the rare Menetries tiger moth, and it feeds on the red aconite.
So if I remember correctly from reading the press release that we saw when this story originally came out, this moth is like, when we say rare, it's extremely rare, right? Like it hasn't been seen in like 20 or 30 years, I think.
Yeah.
And then like this recent sighting in 2014 or 2015, not only did they see the moth, but they also saw its young, like actually eating the flower. So that's why they know this now, is that like they know that they're kind of living in tandem.
Yeah, and they theorize that the caterpillars are possibly consuming the alcaloids for protection of overwintering larvae against fungal and bacterial diseases.
Huh.
And in this, it's interesting to look again at that bumblebee study where they pointed out that you see aconite levels not only in the bees that are actually visiting the aconite laced plants,
yeah.
but also in their young. So there's like this residual level of aconite just in the species itself based on their primary food source.
Okay, so here's my like totally unscientific dumb question to ask
okay.
then. I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but maybe somebody out in the audience knows. If an old world bumblebee consumes enough aconite and then subsequently stings a human being, will that aconite be passed on to the human being? And then would that be enough of a dosage to poison you?
Based on what I read here, I would
yeah.
say no.
Okay.
Because, they didn't even get into stinging or anything. So
yeah.
I don't know to what degree. For all I know, this might be a non-stinging species.
Yeah, that's true.
But they said that the toxicity levels within the creature itself was not significant.
Okay.
So
okay.
I think you'd
so
be
it'd
fine.
Just be like a little bit of numbness maybe, even if it was passed through the stinger, but it probably wouldn't.
Yeah, I get the sense that you would not get any sensation at all
right.
from it, aside from, of course, the stinging
you know,
sensation.
The pain. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so there you have it. Wolfsbane. From werewolves to Nazis, from traditional Chinese medicine to poisoned arrows and old world bumblebees.
That's the thing about this particular subject that I think is so interesting is it's just, you know, you say, again, like I said at the top, you say wolfsbane and you go, right, yeah, that's in some like goofy werewolf movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got this like fascinating history that just goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's not common knowledge, or maybe at least it's just not to us. I didn't learn this any time in my education.
Yeah, but based on the accounts of poisoning still occurring, both in North America and Europe and in Asia, yeah, people could stand to be a little more educated
yeah.
about wolfsbane.
Yeah, maybe we need to add Wolfsbane 101
yeah.
to the Hogwarts syllabus.
Indeed. All right, so there you have it. Again, if you want to check out more topics from Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, from the very ancient episodes up until the newest. If you want to see, just be right there on the cutting edge of what's coming out, that's the place to go.
Yeah, and like I said at the top of the episode, you know, we are going to start hopefully periscoping at the end of October. So you can find out more information about when we'll be doing those and where you can find those episodes, obviously on Twitter, but also on our Facebook and Tumblr pages, which are Blow the Mind. That's the handle that we use on all of those. And we've got videos as well, the Monster Science stuff that will be on all those channels, and they're already on our YouTube channel.
Yeah, so check it out. And hey, in the meantime, where can people send those accounts of accidental and intentional aconite poisons?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely write us in if you've got some stories on this. So it's blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.